Hello, listeners. This podcast is hosted by International Idea. In the next minutes, we will help you make sense of what's happening today in democracy worldwide.
Welcome to Democracy Ideas Podcast, the podcast of the International Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance. Today, we'll be talking about Afghanistan. In particular, a report the Institute has just published called The Constitution and the Laws of the Taliban from 1994 to 2001, Hints from the Past and Options for the Future. And I'll be talking to the three authors of the report, and apologies for any mispronunciations of the names. Firstly, Mr. Bashir Mobasher, who is a postdoctoral fellow at the American University's Department of Sociology. Before the fall of Kabul, he was an assistant professor of political science, as well as an author. Secondly, I'll be talking to Shamshad Parsalai, who is a visiting lecturer at the University of Chicago Law School. Again, prior to August 2021, he was a lecturer at Herat University School of Law and Political Science in Afghanistan. And thirdly, Mohammed Ghadam Shah. He's been an assistant professor of global development at the Seattle Pacific University School of Business, Government and Economics since 2020. Welcome to you all. My first question really is about, I wondered, Dr. Bashir, if you could explain how the report came about and what was the kind of research gap that you were trying to fill?
Well, thank you for the introduction. The report, it's a long story, but I'm going to try to make it short for the sake of time. When the negotiation between the United States and the Taliban intensified, obviously, a lot of Afghans were concerned about what kind of legal order we will have in case the Taliban joins the peace process with the Republic government. And that's what we were talking about, discussing together. And we know that most of the literature has focused on the constitution of the Taliban. But what we learned and what we discussed amongst each other, and by we, I mean Dr. Shamshad, Dr. Ghadam Shah, and I, was that the legal order is not limited to the constitution of a political regime. And particularly, it's not the case for the Taliban because they never took their constitutions very seriously. So for example, when they established their constitutions, they created their constitutions in 1998. After that, they made lots of laws. And if you look at those laws, there is no reference to the constitutions of the Taliban. And therefore, we thought we have to take a look at these laws. We have to translate them, analyze them, make it, you know, available for a larger audience, not necessarily just Afghans, but also international audience as well. And that's what when we started this project. And Dr. Shamshad, I have to say, has initiated this process. So I will have to appreciate his, you know, initiation of this whole project. But also we have to take a look at what the Taliban are doing right now, right? So for example, they returned most of the laws that they have created during the first emirate of the Taliban. But the only law that they have not basically reinstated is the constitution of the Taliban. So most of the laws that they had in the emirate of the Taliban, in the first emirate of the Taliban, are back in place and implemented in the second emirate of the Taliban, except for the constitution of the Taliban. And that's why it makes our research very important for the listeners, for the audience. Besides that, you know, if you look at the laws that we worked at, you learn a great deal about, for example, the philosophy of governance. You learn a great deal about, for example, the quality of laws that they have produced. For example, one of the things we have noticed that, for example, from 40 laws that we have translated and analyzed, around 19 of those laws were created and established for some divine purposes. For example, they have some references to the divine punishments. For example, you will be punished on the judgment day. Or for example, even if there are some references to worldly punishment, it's still vague and it still has some references to Sharia. For example, you'll be punished according to Sharia. So there's a great deal that one can learn while looking at the report, by looking at these different laws that we have interpreted and analyzed, that one cannot learn, for example, from the constitution of the Taliban.
Was this, there's a lot of translated laws in the report. Was this the first time that these had been translated into English?
Yeah, so these laws that we have translated are the first of those. So the constitution has been interpreted. There have been some decrees of the Taliban, some messages of the Amir that have been translated, but not this whole bunch of their statutory laws, the decrees that we have translated were not translated before. So so it's very new.
And I have to say, as a lay reader, I found that some of the translations really fascinating, just to see the inner workings of the Taliban and see in detail the kind of laws, and how they were expressing. I thought it was really quite quite interesting indeed.
Yeah, can I add something to that?
Of course.
First of all, thank you, Alistair, for this, and really happy to be here with my co-authors. Just, I agree with Dr. Bashir, and just to echo what he said, I think it was in 2016 when we became in contact with International IDEA through the Afghanistan Constitutional Studies Institute. And as Dr. Bashir pointed out, so when in June 2018, it was the U.S. government sat with the Taliban representatives in Doha, Qatar, to kind of negotiate some sort of a settlement of the Afghan context. And that kind of, as Dr. Bashir pointed out, gave rise to some very rigorous interest into the legal thinkings of the Taliban. So what a lot of foreign and Afghan researchers and scholars had at their disposal was only this document, the Taliban's constitution that was apparently drafted in 1998. So that was the only document that was in circulation. And there was another document that was that's called the Laiha, that was in, that I think its two iterations came, one in 2006 or 8, and then the other in 2010. So those were the documents that all the research kind of focused on. And when we were looking at the Afghan official gazette, me, Dr. Bashir and Dr. Shah, said that, hey, there's a lot of documents. And the two documents that the research kind of centers on do not kind of paint a fairly comprehensive picture of the Taliban's thinking or approach, as underdeveloped as it was, to legal their legal imaginations, if you will. So that's what we thought, and we contacted the International IDEA that this is something that we would like to do, and we think that will kind of fill a huge gap in trying to, part of the gap at least, in trying to understand the Taliban. So it's an International IDEA agreed to do that. And then, as Alistair, you pointed out, so the documents that we do not translate, present the translation of the draft constitution or the constitution that was written in 1998, but we translated and produced like an introduction to some of the laws that we thought, without which we could not understand the Taliban's legal imaginations or legal vision or even constitutional vision. So as the report highlights, I think that's one of the gaps that it should be able to fill.
Thanks. And Dr. Shamshad, a lot of people will know, more or less, they have some kind of basic knowledge about the Taliban, but perhaps you could just give us a brief summary of the Taliban and its stance on constitution, something I had no idea about before this report.
Of course, the Taliban, the origins of the Taliban's movement is something that both Afghan and foreign, non-Afghan, if you will, researchers or scholars of the Taliban movement or even Afghanistan disagree on. But it, in a nutshell, the Taliban's movement was essentially formed by students and teachers of religion, of Islam, who had traditionally studied at madrasas or religious schools in the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan. So its origins, again, in short, some of the figures who would later become high Taliban officials, high-ranking Taliban officials, were part of the war about the jihad against the Soviet Union. And when the Soviet Union withdrew from Afghanistan, so most of these leaders that who would later become leaders kind of retreated back to their religious teaching and preaching in the countryside. And then the civil war erupted between those, the Mujahideen or the holy warriors, as they are known, or the parties who had fought or resisted the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. So the civil war, of course, created a lot of disorder and chaos, basically lawlessness in the country. So that also kind of prompted the leader of the Taliban or the founder, the Mullah Muhammad Umar, to rally some of his students. And the first was a small kind of achievement that they had was freeing a caravan, a commercial caravan that was crossing by and was held at by the so-called warlords. And from there, it was, I think, the summer of 1994 that the Taliban literally exploded and went on to conquer a lot of Afghanistan until 9/11 happened. And that story is, I think, fairly obvious to a lot of the listeners and a lot of the scholars and readers as well. The Taliban in the first rule, when they could rule the country from 1994 to 2001, were not too much concentrated or centered on the legal aspects of their government. So they ruled by force, and as some of their leaders would say, that what they are spending a lot of their resources, energy, and time free Afghanistan from warlords. And once they do that, then they will come to thinking about the question of what a constitution would be or how to govern the country. And certainly their thinking of what a constitution is or what a constitution does was not very developed, even still it doesn't seem to be very developed and sophisticated when their leaders talk about a constitutional structure of the government. But when they conquered Kabul in 1996 and 97, those were the times that they thought like they need to create a bureaucracy and then draft the laws that will structure those bureaucracies in the state. And as they did that, they suddenly seemed to thought about, okay, all the regimes, previous regimes in Afghanistan and other countries had ratified a constitution. And that seems to be important to structuring a government, not necessarily limiting it, but just giving it a structure. So some scholars say that they reached out to the Jamaat-e-Ulama-e-Islami in Pakistan to help them draft a constitution. And the Jamaat-e-Islami seemed to kind of prepare a draft constitution, but it's so obscure that no one knows what that draft was. And then in 1998, Mullah Muhammad Umar issues a decree in which he instructs a council to draft a constitution, and then that constitution that, as we discussed earlier, that was written and being discussed in the scholarship and in research was written. That is how it came into being. But as Dr. Bashir Pai pointed out in his remarks, so that document was not really followed or respected. Again, showing the inexperience or lack of expertise or the ideological developments within the Taliban when it comes to questions of constitutional governance. And then after 2001, they turned into a guerrilla warfare, still busy in warfares, and again thinking less and less on questions of constitutional governance. And again, when they took control of Kabul in 2021, they still seem to grapple or to struggle with the idea of what a constitutional governance or structure of governance would look like.
And moving, Dr. Shah, when moving on from that history, what is that current state of the Afghan constitution, so to speak, after their move into Kabul?
Yeah, so with the Taliban coming into Kabul and taking over Afghanistan once again, the 2004 constitution practically suspended, and the Taliban will, in that situation of deciding whether they want to move on with a new constitution or reinstate their own constitution, or there were some promises at the beginning that they would reinstate the 1964 constitution, with the exception of provisions that relate to elections or the presidents or any provision that they deemed not compatible with the Sharia law. So with that, the current status of the constitution, despite all those promises, they did not continue that. They did not, in fact, meet those promises, but they started to implement their own version of governance that has a lot of resemblance to what they have been, drafted in their constitution. And this project also shows a lot of flaws that match with what the Taliban are trying to implement. So in a nutshell, I can say that since they have come to office, there's not been any constitution, but they have been implementing most of the laws that we have translated. And in terms of constitution, they are following the provisions of their constitution from 1998 and then 2005. So if you look at the structure of the government, their cabinet style, and the way the Amir is taking control of the government in different aspects, administratively, politically, and fiscally, there is a lot of resemblance with their version of constitution and their approach to governance.
Could you explain a bit, you know, I mean, I think from an outside perspective, I think a lot of people would say, you know, they just see Afghanistan as a religious dictatorship, right? And they would probably say, why would a constitution actually matter, or why would a Taliban constitution actually matter in a kind of autocratic dictatorial government like the Taliban? Could you perhaps explain what the kind of influence and impact and the importance of a constitution, even under something as dictatorial as a Taliban regime, can mean for an ordinary Afghan, why it matters?
So the constitution as a legitimating tool, legitimizing tool, has been important always for any type of government, especially after 1990s. The countries, even the dictatorial governments, have been trying to adopt the constitution to at least show to their citizens, to their people, that there are some sort of constitutional order and some sort of legitimacy. So for the Taliban as well, it is important to have that sort of legitimizing tool in place so that they can rely on that, and they can at least show to the people that they have a constitution in place. But so far, since they have come to power, it doesn't seem that they are giving a lot of importance to that. It is more sort of de facto implementing their constitution without even without having a formal constitution in place or formal declared constitution in place to follow and have the citizen to know their rights and privileges in the society.
Aside from the idea, you know, of something being the legitimization of the Taliban, how does it make an impact, let's say, on the individual Afghan who's perhaps, you know, doing either business or has, certain kinds of legal conflicts, certain kinds of relationships with the government or with courts, etc.? Or do they not need it at the moment?
I'll just quickly make a short comment in that respect. That's a good question. I think an important question that needs to be discussed. Autocrats, authoritarians, even dictators in the modern world love constitutions, and there's been a lot of research into that. But the question is, it's not for the Taliban what the constitution would do for them, but it's for the ordinary Afghan. And I will quickly highlight is that it could be important to them just to understand what they can or cannot do, to put it very, very simply. Because currently the Afghan population do not know what action or is permitted, what is not, what their rights and duties are. So it's only by doing a certain act that they kind of find out, okay, this was something that was apparently prohibited. A lot of the civil society activists who are arrested after a small protest seems to be like that. Yeah, it will not do much to the ordinary population, but just to, again, in a very simple and layman's term, to give them some kind of predictability about what can or cannot they do. Currently, the Taliban, it seems that Dr. Shah pointed out, and I think we highlight in the report too, is that the 2004 constitution remains suspended. All the other laws, civil code, criminal code, also seem to be suspended. The Taliban have started a process of reviewing all the laws of the former government to determine or to decide which of these laws are consistent with their own brand of Islamic law so that they could be reenacted or allowed to be followed in the courts and give a sense to the people. Until that review is complete, it seems that there is no written law to say the minimum that would give us some sort of predictability.
Okay, thanks.
And to just to add to that, I think the original question you asked has like two parts. The first part is in international employees see the Taliban constitution as for Afghanistan generally as religious dictatorship. The thing is that most of the politicians who are involved in the politics of Afghanistan, so people like, for example, Zalman Khalilzad, the chief negotiator of the United States in the Doha Agreement, for example, General Nick Carter, the chief of defense of the United Kingdom, for example, Leo de Burra, and many more, actually. Amina Mohammed, the deputy secretary general of the United Nations, seem to suggest or portray the picture of the Taliban as a more moderate religious group. In some ways, try to basically paint a different picture of the Taliban in order to promote or advance the relationship between the Taliban and the international community, and in some ways advocate for the recognition of the Taliban and providing the Afghan state for the Taliban in the United Nations. So I would argue that there are also international figures, even some institutions who are actually promoting the Taliban and the regime and the constitution, building something very different from what they are, which is, as you say, religious dictatorship. And in terms of why it should matter for the Afghans, my view is their constitution didn't matter for them. As I suggested earlier, for example, after 1998, which their constitution was supposedly drafted and established, no other laws have made any reference to the constitution. So they have the law on constitutional council, right? And it was, I believe, in 1999. And even that particular law, the law on the council of constitution, has no reference to the constitution of the Taliban. So the main responsibility and duty of that council was to look at the laws and see whether they are compatible with Islamic and Sharia values, which in their own version of Sharia and Islamic values. And there was only one reference to the constitution, which was vague, and it wasn't necessarily reference to the constitution of the Taliban in that particular case. So even when they returned to Afghanistan in 2021, August of 2021, so they made a couple of references publicly to different constitutions that they would like to restore, mostly for the international convention, because they want recognition of international community, they want funding from the international community, and they want their seat in the United Nations. So they said, for example, we will restore the constitution of 2004. They at least said it once. And then they suggested that we're going to bring back the constitution of 1964. But they have made no reference to their own constitution of 1998, or they made no reference to the fact that they might actually create a new constitution. So it doesn't matter for themselves. It seems if it doesn't matter for themselves, it should matter for the Afghan community as well. And in addition to that, if you look at the constitution, also the laws of the Taliban, it's all about institutionalization of intolerance, institutionalization of misogyny, institutionalization of dictatorship. And it's all against the values of the Afghans. And if the only way it matters for the Afghan community is, for example, as Dr. Shamsher suggested, just the matter of predictability of the constitution and the fact that their rights and their liberty and freedom would be further limited and restricted and in a lot of ways taken away.
Okay, thanks. And Dr. Sharp, what are the main conclusions of the report?
So yes, this report has a number of conclusions. The first one that we would like to highlight is that the Taliban approach to governance, as my colleagues highlighted just now, presents some sort of ambiguity in terms of what the Taliban governance would look like, the legal structure, the people's rights and privileges, duties and responsibilities in the society. So this report highlights that, and despite the fact that we are translating different laws of the Taliban, the practice basically shows something different in the sense that the people would not have any idea about their rights and privileges, duties and responsibilities in the society, and that just create a legal vacuum in the society. And that directly or indirectly impact the law and order in the society. And the people basically are losing their citizen rights in the society, and they would not be able to practice them as they do. The other conclusion that the report is trying to highlight is to show that the constitution that the Taliban are talking about is not fitting with the Afghan culture, Afghan demand in terms of governance, in terms of rights and privileges. Given the diversity of the Afghan population, the laws and regulations that the Taliban are promoting and trying to impose on the Afghan people are far away from reality in the Afghan society. And finally, as it has been claimed by different scholars since the emergence of the Taliban and especially after 2021, this report is also highlighting that the Taliban do not have a theorized version of governance so that people can refer to and trying to make an understanding of how they think and how they imagine the governance to be like. So this report is filling that gap, is trying to provide that picture for the audience, for the readers, to get a sense of the Taliban's governance structure and legal structure in the Afghan society.
Just to add to what Dr. Shah so succinctly articulated, It's one there's a lot of work on the Taliban's origin, some written by the members of the Taliban themselves. I think we're not in shortage of that historical anthropological and ideological kind of works on about the Taliban. So we don't understand, we won't understand the Taliban completely and in a nuanced way without looking at these translations that are produced in this report. The historical work is fantastic. There's a wonderful work on the origins of the Taliban, how they developed, how they governed. That is there. But this report kind of concludes that major point that if we want to understand the Taliban's approach to a legal order, then these laws are important to look at. Some say that we look at liberal theory and then use that to understand the Taliban. I think that's flawed. That type of an approach will be completely flawed to understanding the Taliban. It's these translations that kind of give us some hints about how they approach a legal order and how they may approach and see it in the future as they transition from this guerrillas, if you will, to governors.
Thanks. And Dr. Shamshed, the report's kind of subtitle says hints from the past and options for the future. Perhaps could you elaborate a bit what you think these options are?
Yes, it's we as we move forward in the Taliban's de facto government in the country, the options seem to appear dimmer as we move forward. But there is some, at least as we highlighted, like one option could be to writing a constitution, to doing like structuring a constitutional governance would be of benefit to them also, to just write a constitution. Yes, that will be an autocratic constitution, but again, this could be something that could give us some ideas of what they would. And the major option that I would highlight, and then one of my former supervisor, current mentor and supervisor, wrote a piece on what the options could be. And I think we kind of expanded on that in the report as well, is to look at Islamic governance, to look at Islamic political theory, even modernist theory or even the traditionalist theory. There will be very valid and viable options. We would not like it, we would not agree with it, or that would not sound very attractive to us. But this could be something that at least will create a legitimate sense of governance, or a governance that will government that will be attentive more to the needs and desires of the governed rather than as it is today. It's only the governor who takes all the privileges, immunities, the wishes, and whatever they want, as if the governed or the population in this case has no rights, no the privileges before the law. So I'll just give you one example. So in Islamic political theory, there is some restrictions put on the powers of the ruler. One is public welfare. So a government, an Islamic government, is at least one of the theories. One of its responsibilities is to work for the welfare of the nation, to welfare of the governed. So that could be something that would kind of attach some strings to the current dictatorial way of the Taliban's government. So there could be options, some very hard, some very viable, some would be that would emerge from within the legal or the Islamic political tradition to which the Taliban themselves are very accustomed to. So this has to be looked at instead of thinking the way that governing this nation, this population, or the Afghans is a God-given privilege to this particular group to do whatever you want to bring the people in line with religion or to shepherd them towards the right path. I think that is a very flawed approach that the Taliban have now attached themselves to.
Do you see, is there any evidence of that debate going on at the moment within Afghanistan? You were just saying that issue of Islamic law.
It used to be before the Taliban came to power. So in the Taliban, the figures affiliated with the Taliban in their writings, in their public speeches, in their interviews, that discourse seemed to be there. But that was before they took over Afghanistan. And as Dr. Bashir highlighted, to kind of present themselves as a more viable option to the international community. It was the Taliban's members themselves who wrote books on this kind of Islamic governance and how God would love a government that takes care of the people that the government governs. But I am, and my colleagues here can highlight if they are aware of, I have not seen any of that debate as lively as it was before the Taliban took over, as compared to after they took control of Kabul. That debate seems to have kind of subsided, at least, or is not, you know, very articulate or forward in social media or within the Taliban circle.
And I guess, looking forward with Afghanistan, I guess one of the major concerns is about just the stability, within Afghanistan after, 3 or 4 decades of just almost continuous war. How does the Taliban stance on the constitution, this what you've been talking about now, at this podcast, bode for political and ethnic religious stability in the country? Bashir?
Well, okay. So, constitution is a very big change. It's also a big one in a sense that we look at it from a different perspective and we get different meanings from it. So if you look at it from a liberal democratic perspective, we tend to think of constitution serving at least two purposes, protecting the rights and freedom of citizens, but also establishing a structure for the government. Now, for the Taliban constitution, but also for other authoritarian regimes, constitution is something very different from what we perceive it to be. So for them, it's particularly if you look at the constitution of the Taliban, it's sort of a law of obligations rather than law of rights and liberties of the citizens. Yes, it does talk about the structure of the governance, but it does not talk about protecting the freedom of individuals. So if you look at the laws of the Taliban, and if you look at the laws that, for example, we have interpreted, one of the laws specifically mentions about intolerating immoral crimes and religious crimes. It specifically mentions about that. If you look at the constitution of the Taliban, it does talk about Amir, but it does not talk about how an Amir assumes office, who selects them, who elects them, how the person gets, to become the Amir of the Taliban. And another important factor about, the issue of, for example, ethno-religious stability. I'm not sure if the Taliban's constitution of 98 or any other constitution, based on what they are doing right now, based on the kind of law that they are, enforcing on the people, is going to bring any sort of stability, because Taliban are ethno-religiously very exclusive. So they have not included any regimes and their lawmaking aspects of it, or even if they create a constitutional council or something like that, I'm not sure if they're gonna include people from the opposition group, people from, for example, different other religious groups, from different ethnic groups. And if you look at the history of the constitutions of Afghanistan, one thing you can learn is that all of these constitutions have failed because they were all, in one sense or another, have been exclusive. They have excluded one group or the other group. And eventually, as the history tells us, people who have been excluded and marginalized from the constitution are going to be the individual, the people or the groups who take over the next time and then create their own exclusive constitution. And that is something that we see with the Taliban's constitutional vision, if we call that it's exclusive, and the theme of the constitution is intolerance. So, for example, if it talks about, for example, freedom of speech, it does talk about freedom of speech only in the context of promoting religious values, not anything besides that, right? So we do remember, for example, the Minister of Higher Education on the Taliban telling the professors of Kabul University that if you say anything against the Taliban, you will not see the next morning. So it's about intolerance, it's about exclusion, and therefore, I'm not sure if the Constitution of the Taliban, in the same way that they are functioning, in the same way that they are making laws at the moment, is going to bring any sort of stability in Afghanistan, or bring diverse ethnic or religious groups together, because that's not their vision. If I just give a reference to one of the most important books that the Supreme Court Justice of the Taliban have produced, Hakim Haqqani, right? The book is called The Islamic Emirate. And in that book, it does talk about, for example, we should establish only one sect of Islam, which is Hanafi sect, as the sect of the religion. We cannot recognize the United sect because it's not proper, it's not Islamic. And it does talk about, for example, the women of Afghanistan, they cannot participate in the political process. They cannot work. They can get education, but they can get education within their own home from their family members. They cannot get education outside. And this is a very important book because it is produced, it's written by the Supreme Court Justice of the Taliban, and it was endorsed by the Supreme Leader of the Taliban. And if we think of any constitution vision of the Taliban, at the moment that book represents it.
Thanks, Bashir. Before we wrap up this podcast, Shamshad or Bashir or Karam, is there anything you'd like to touch upon that we haven't talked about? You'd like to mention any theme or question?
Yeah, I will. As Dr. Shah prepares to state his concluding remarks, I would just highlight in response to this your question to Dr. Bashir, and then highlight things that have not been covered. Speaking, of course, at the risk of making a claim based on limited or no hard data, is that the Taliban's constitution in the future, if they try to draft one, does not seem to bode very well for ethnic and religious stability or accommodation or inclusion. As Dr. Bashir pointed out, they are very exclusive. They are predominantly from Pashtun ethnic groups. And there was one of the news media outlets picked up on something on TV yesterday where a banner was written in Pashto, English, and Chinese, I suppose. And then they were complaining that the Dari is missing from that sort of, as a sign of that lack of attention to kind of ethnic accommodation. And in terms of religion, as Dr. Bashir again so well articulated, the Taliban are predominantly from the Hanafi school and trained in the Deobandi madrasas. Yesterday, the minister of inviting to do the good and prohibiting the evil, or Amr bil Ma'ruf wa Nahy an Munkar, he said that the Amir has agreed to have Shia Muhtasibs. Muhtasibs are these religious figures, used to be religious figures, but now it seems that Taliban fighters who walk around the street to make sure that people go to the masjid to pray, they observe religion and observe all the ethics that they have. So that's something that they said they agreed. But again, if it comes to any position of power, the Amir, my hunch is that they have to say they must be a Hanafi follower. The prime minister, the same ministers seem to be the same. So overall, it doesn't seem to bode well. But again, they use brute force to suppress any opposition, any dissident opinions, opinions that they don't welcome. So that's in response to that question. And finally, I would just highlight that we need to I think everyone needs to be very realistic when it comes to the Taliban. One of the major complaints that I had when the peace process with the Taliban started, and I think Dr. Bashir and Dr. Qadamshah would agree with me on this, was how the Taliban were kind of romanticized. They both figures inside and outside the Afghanistan, I don't know if romanticized were the correct word or not, but so what they did is they painted a very good picture of the Taliban as if suddenly there is some Taliban 2.0 who will allow women to go to school, to work, who would respect the laws, who would respect even the Islamic legal tradition that will allow them to be some moderate in terms of dealing with the governed. So that picture seemed to be ill-founded, to say the least, because since they took power, we have seen like there's not a lot that has changed with the Taliban. Well, girls still can't go to school, women cannot work, and all of the edicts and the orders of the Ministry of Vice and Virtue is just keep suppressing women's rights and minorities and engaging in all different types of violations. So that's I think I would highlight to be realistic when we look at the Taliban and to understand them. And I hope that this report would help us towards kind of looking at the Taliban through that lens of what they have done rather than what they ought to do, and kind of be very, idealistic in thinking about what they would do.
Well, thanks very much. That's been a fascinating conversation. Thanks so much to all three of you for finding the time to talk to our podcast. And good luck on the next research report.
No, thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Democracy Ideas podcast. Keep following International Idea on social media. We need all of you to participate in constructing better societies. Goodbye.